There are a lot of very important systems in the world today that, with even a little bit of critical analysis, don't really make that much sense. Private equity has become a multi-trillion dollar staple of the investing industry, but it seems to make more money from financial shell games than it does from actually running businesses, and yet people are still giving these firms trillions of dollars. The rest of the market is being kept afloat by technology almost everybody admits is some kind of bubble, new creative flavors of debt are being sold off as revolutionary new ways of empowering spending, but at the same time, the consumers that all of this relies on are more broke than ever before. It seems like across the entire economy, nobody is actually making any money, but everybody is getting paid as long as they go along with it. The one thing that ties all this together is the unshakable belief that, by the time this delicate system unravels, it will be someone else's problem.
I'm back. I want to shift to the debt conversation.
Klarna's buy now, pay later interest-free loan model may be backfiring. The financial services company net loss more than doubled in the first quarter.
Valuation stands at $19.65 billion. The Swedish fintech upsized its IPO, indicating very strong demand for the 20-year-old company.
There are a lot of homeowners right now who can't afford to move even if they wanted to.
Trillion dollars this year, partly due to high prices.
But let's start with these markets, as we just heard Brian mention. The S&P and NASDAQ record highs again.
Okay, so back in the 1970s, companies had a problem. Their executives were just regular employees that were collecting a paycheck like everybody else. Their paycheck was larger, but actually not that much larger than a regular employee. According to data from the Economic Policy Institute, the average CEO of one of the largest 350 companies in 1965 earned just over 20 times more than the average employee. This was partially because average workers earned more and because executives earned significantly less year to year. This was obviously a big problem because it encouraged executives to hold on to their jobs long term and not take too many risks so they could keep on earning this comfortable salary. Back then, the average tenure of a top executive was roughly double what it is today, and the average company spent roughly twice as much time in the S&P 500. At this time, most of the profits these companies made were reinvested back into the company itself to acquire new business, research and develop new products, and pay their staff. Eventually, shareholders figured out that it was better to pay these executives larger bonuses based on performance, especially performance that returned more money to them. Now, hot take alert, but this by itself is completely reasonable. Shareholders own the company, and they should make sure that there are systems in place to align employee incentives with their own objectives. And of course, their number one objective is getting a return on their investment. Where things did start to go a little bit off the rails, though, was when a law that significantly limited stock buybacks was repealed in 1982. This let executives use company money to buy back their own shares on the public market, which did a few things. The first thing was that it increased the share price even if the company wasn't actually doing any better. When this law was repealed, the average company in the S&P 500 had a price-to-earnings ratio of about 6.2, which meant 6.2 years of company profits would cover the price of the company's shares. Today, that PE ratio is over 36, which really just means that shares are roughly 6 times more expensive than they were in 1982 for the same amount of profit. This is great for existing shareholders, but makes the whole market a lot more questionable in terms of true value. Buybacks also make financial metrics like earnings per share look better, but not because the company makes more money, but rather because there are just fewer shares. Now, another hot take alert, but even this was arguably good for shareholders who enjoyed capital appreciation and tax-efficient stock returns. But as the late Charlie Munger once said, "Show me the incentive and I will show you the outcome." Stock buybacks are kind of like crack for corporate finance. They will get that stock price high even if the rest of the business is falling apart, or even if they are causing the rest of the business to fall apart. Stock buybacks started as an alternative to dividends that could be used when the executive team believed that the company stock was undervalued. That eventually gave way as more money started to be spent on buybacks than dividends, and then more money was spent on buybacks than reinvestment into the business itself to fund R&D or workforce development. A lot of companies took it even further than this, and spent more on stock buybacks than the company was making in profit. They did this by borrowing money to buy their own shares back from their own investors, which is why corporate debt is at all-time highs. Now, for most businesses, this was clearly very dumb, but it pumped stock prices enough for CEOs to make absolutely enormous bonuses. The average CEO now earns more than 340 times more than their average employee. And with such enormous fortunes that can be made in such little time, it's very hard for anybody to not play the game. Of course, it's not sustainable. But that's next quarter's problem. So it's time to learn how money works to find out what happens when the next quarter finally arrives. This week's video is sponsored by NordVPN, who partnered with me to help keep you safer online because the internet can still feel like the digital Wild West. NordVPN's mission is to make the internet safer, more private, and free from tracking, censorship, and those sketchy moments when a website just does not feel right. With one click, you get a fast, secure VPN that protects your connection anywhere in the world. And with Threat Protection Pro, Nord goes beyond a normal VPN by blocking malware, stopping phishing attempts, and warning you if you are about to land on a fake online shop. It has already helped me once when I almost bought from a site that looked a little too generous. Threat Protection Pro flagged it immediately, and I backed away before giving a scammer my card details. You can also turn on Dark Web Monitor, which keeps an eye on leaked credentials and alerts you if any of your information shows up anywhere it should not. To try it yourself, go to www.nordvpn.com/moneyuncut or hit the link in the description for the exclusive NordVPN deal plus 4 extra months free. It is completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money back. So corporate buybacks have been bad for workers, bad for the economy, and worst of all, it's been bad for the investors. But people already knew this, and there is a reason that they simply don't care. Over a decade ago, one of the CEOs broke rank and wrote in an open letter that too many companies have cut capital expenditures and even increased debt to boost dividends and increase share buybacks. That was back in 2014, in what people thought was the peak of the buyback mania. Since then, quarterly buybacks have roughly doubled, despite interest rates being much higher, which would theoretically make businesses want to hold on to cash rather than borrowing it. But that's a problem for next quarter. By the way, the CEO that betrayed his executive comrades to raise the alarm about how share buybacks had undermined the market was none other than Larry Fink, the head of BlackRock, the largest asset manager in the world. So yeah, it's pretty easy to blame the rise in short-term thinking on corporate executives using questionable financial strategies to make themselves incredibly wealthy. But they are really just a symptom of a much bigger problem that goes well beyond corporate America. And there are a few reasons why this is happening. The first reason is that there is now a lot more money to be made in value extraction rather than value creation. William Lozonik, a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts, wrote about this in a now infamous paper titled Profits Without Prosperity. He noted that between the end of the Second World War and the early 1970s, most businesses became successful by creating value for consumers or other businesses. Today, that's much harder, as companies are trying to keep up with their financial commitments to shareholders. Over time, more money for research and development has come from the government instead, as companies have spent what they used to spend on R&D on pumping up their own stocks. Today, corporate profits are at all-time highs, while a record number of companies are actually losing money. This again is largely the result of short-term business planning. As companies' price-to-earnings ratios have expanded, the best way for innovators to get money out of their ideas is not actually to run a business. It's to scale a business and then sell it. When average company PE ratios were 5 to 6, that means it would take 5 to 6 years for the business to cover its purchase price. Good founders would rather stick with their business because they could make that money back pretty quickly. Today, some valuations are easily as high as 100 times earnings, so founders and early investors would be long dead before the company has had time to make more money than what they could just get by selling. Now, some of these companies could continue to grow, but a lot of them still fail. A lot of them never make any profit at all, but still make their founders very wealthy. Big existing companies don't mind this, because it lets them simply purchase the best ideas before they can compete with them, and they don't need to take the risks of funding their own technical development. Even still, the net earnings of the largest listed companies in America is claiming the highest share of GDP in history, which in plain English means corporate profits make up more of our economy than ever with the exception of early pandemic stimulus. So, where are these profits coming from? Well, there are only two customers left who still have money to fund these profits. The first is very wealthy people who have, so far, benefited from stretched asset values, but we spoke about them in last week's video. If there is, some kind of shakeup that impacts asset markets, these people will cut back on their spending, which could create a bad feedback loop. Lower spending by the only people who can still afford to spend, leading to lower company earnings, leading to market drops, leading to further reduced spending. Of course, the market can stay irrational for a long time, but this is one of the risks of having too much economic activity dependent on a small group of people. But don't worry, there is a backup. The other big spender is the government, who either directly through contracts or grants or indirectly through other spending has been such a big driver of corporate profits that you probably didn't even realize that I mixed up these charts.
They're the same picture.
Through contracts, schemes, deferments, subsidies, incentives, co-investments, bailouts, financial protection programs, offsets, bonuses, grants, public-private partnerships, guarantees, and intellectual property awards, there are limitless avenues for businesses to make money off government spending. This is not to mention new initiatives like the potential cryptocurrency reserve, which will also largely benefit institutional asset holders. But that's a whole different discussion. Now, to be fair, regardless of party, over the last 50 years, the government has become an incredibly lucrative customer. Just federal government expenditure now accounts for more than a third of our GDP, which is higher than even the total war economy of 1944. Other countries like the UK are higher, but here in America, we also have significant spending done by state governments as well, so it's not an entirely fair comparison. Business executives are not the only people guilty of looking out for their own short-term interests at the expense of wider long-term consequences. Government programs that put money into people's pockets, create employment, and promise to solve big problems are really easy to announce. But once they are operating, they are really hard to roll back, because nobody wants to be the politician laying off workers ahead of the next election. As Lozonik noted in his article, this has over time created a system of profits without prosperity. And now, even those profits are balancing on a delicate system of speculative wealth and unsustainable government spending. So yeah, I guess we gotta talk about it. The Doge in the room. Now, the disappointing part of all of this is that almost everybody agrees that cutting back on government spending is a good initiative that should make businesses less reliant on taxpayer money and the economy as a whole more fiscally sound. But we have now built such a big debt-filled house of cards on such a precarious system that walking these programs back will take meticulous planning over years, if not decades, to avoid any runaway economic complications. Impulsive sweeping changes done over the course of weeks to grab some headlines is exactly the same kind of short-term thinking that got us into this mess in the first place. Realistically, the biggest source of fat that can be cut is the various cost-plus contracts awarded to companies with immense lobbying pressure. Even those cutbacks should be done slowly and carefully, and probably not be overseen by one of the biggest beneficiaries of government funding. We have asset markets reaching record stretch valuations, held up by record corporate and government debt, which can no longer rely on genuine household spending because their savings are at record lows and their debt is also at record highs. Now, this kind of short-term planning is nothing new. Human nature did not change in the 1970s. And before this turns into another episode of Angry Stickman points at historic financial data, the more important question is, what can be done about this? You should probably acknowledge that if you ever found yourself as the CEO of a major public company and you had the opportunity to secure a lucrative options package by doing a share buyback, you would probably do it. I mean, I know I would certainly do it. Executive compensation has become so generous that just 1 or 2 years of these bonuses can set your family up for generations. And if the company crashes and burns after that, it really doesn't matter. For you. Kinda sucks for the employees, though. The same basic truth is true for starting a company. It doesn't need to be a viable business anymore. It just needs to shake things up that it gets it acquired. There are buyouts that happen every single day that would also comfortably set people up for life. Now, the solution to these problems are the same old boring solutions to almost every problem in corporate America. Regulate the financial fuckery that the CEOs are allowed to pull with their own stocks and control corporate consolidation. If people can only get rich slowly, then the next quarter becomes their problem again. The last big problem is that a lot of people in leadership positions in businesses or the government have become extremely old. There is no point thinking about next quarter if you aren't going to be alive for it. By now, pay later companies now have over $500 trillion worth of debt on their books, according to estimates from industry groups. The exact number is harder to track than something like total credit card debt, because these companies are not required to record their lending practices in the same way. Either way, this is an especially concerning amount of money, because by design, buy now pay later loans should only last 8 weeks before they are paid off in a predictable installment plan. But new research and company confessions have revealed what you probably already knew. People aren't really paying off their Klarna account. They are just using it as a new way to make their month go a little bit further at the end of their money. Most of the largest buy now pay later companies are barely 10 years old now. But in that time, they have been able to scale rapidly thanks to a combination of generous investor funding, a tech bro attitude towards regulations, and a service that was appealing to people who didn't want to go through a formal credit application process, for whatever reason. The argument was that these companies weren't giving out loans. They were just letting people split up their purchase into smaller payments made over a set time period. And if everything was done properly, the users wouldn't even need to pay interest. But now, after giving out quick, easy not loans to anybody who could download an app, the companies are pulling a shocked Pikachu that their not debt is not getting paid back. Now, consumer debt defaults are on the rise everywhere, but BNPL has its own risks that could make this a whole lot worse than people not being able to split up their Costco hot dog into four easy payments. On the surface, buy now, pay later services are not a drastically different financial product to a credit card. Both let you make purchases now and let you pay it off later. Both offer interest-free periods if you make your payments on time, and both have been embraced by companies that want to sell you shit because they make it easier to spend money you don't have. Now, it's true that both of these financing options have extremely high interest rates and fees if you don't make your payments on time. And while buy now, pay later companies tend to try to hide these risks, I hope it isn't shocking to you that delinquent, unsecured consumer debt is considered very risky, and therefore attracts a high interest rate. But for financial tools that seem so similar at face value, there is one big difference that people tend to overlook. According to data collected by the Fed, credit cards are some of the most profitable products that banks offer to their customers. Even including their interest-free purchase periods, the banks still make returns four times higher on credit card lending than other products like mortgages, commercial lending, and traditional personal loans. Buy now, pay later companies, on the other hand, have struggled to turn a profit at all. In fact, most of them have been making spectacular losses. According to public financials, a firm lost nearly $500 million last year, which was actually an improvement on the year before, where they lost nearly a full $1 billion. Other companies like Afterpay, Klarna, and PayPal's Pay in 4 are harder to get data on because they are either private companies that don't have to publicly disclose their financials, or they were acquired by other companies, which mixes in their losses with profits from other parts of the business. Klarna has raised a lot of capital from the ever-reliable SoftBank to scale its business operations. The company did claim to have some quarters of profitability thanks to their creative use of AI to cut down on customer support expenses. But a lot of that was actually thanks to low borrowing costs, a generous interpretation of how reliably their customers would repay their installments, and ignoring everything else that it takes to run the business. The company's actual profit for the quarter was a nearly $100 million loss, doubling from the same time last year. In the supposed golden age of buy now, pay later, the industry leader has had to put off its IPO because it's not clear if the business is even viable. These losses are occurring across the industry despite the fact that these companies typically take a larger cut of sales from merchants and charge higher effective interest rates on delinquencies. Because, oh yeah, even if you don't personally use any of these services, you are still paying the price for them. The way that buy now, pay later companies were supposed to make their money was by charging a higher than normal merchant fee from the retailers that use them as a payment option. Mass market credit card processors like Square, Stripe, Shopify, or PayPal usually charge merchants around 1.5% to 3.5% on sales to take credit card payments, according to data from NerdWallet and the company's own information portals. Buy now, pay later companies have started charging as much as 8% on sales to average retailers, according to a report by Merchant Cost Consulting. Larger companies like Walmart, Amazon, and DoorDash can negotiate these rates individually, but those agreements are largely kept private. For many retailers, 8% represents their entire profit margin after costs and expenses on a sale, so paying that much to a buy now, pay later company is untenable. The problem is that the merchant agreements of buy now, pay later companies forbids retailers from passing along these fees to customers, so they have an option. Either make no profit on sales through platforms like Klarna, or raise prices for everybody to cover this new expense. Now, the third option would be to not offer these payment options at all. But companies don't want to do that for three simple reasons. The first is that buy now, pay later customers are the perfect kind of customers. According to industry data, they are much younger than formal credit card users, spend more impulsively, and have purchasing power thanks to being able to split up their payments. A report published by the Harvard Business Review found that after consumers started using buy now, pay later services, they were 17 to 26% more likely to make a purchase. Not only that, but their average purchase was 10% larger than it was with normal payment methods, leading to an overall increase of 30% in discretionary spending. A 30% increase in spending on non-essentials is not something that the average household can reasonably afford right now, especially amongst the groups attracted to BNPL. For people who can get access to them and use them responsibly, credit cards are an overall better value proposition. They have more flexible terms, they have better reward programs, and they can help users build up their credit. They are also more strictly regulated because they are officially classified as a debt. Buy now, pay later companies have so far dodged that official classification, which means they are not as tightly regulated, which means they can give credit to people who would otherwise struggle to get it. Now, this is not to say that credit cards are some flawless financial product. They too can easily let people spend money they don't have on they don't need. But there are more rules about responsible lending. Since BNPL applications don't show up on official credit reporting records, it also lets particularly self-destructive users pull some impressive financial maneuvers. People can get a credit card and apply for BNPL loans at the same time without each of the lenders knowing about the others. They can then use their credit card to make their BNPL payments, stretching out the period between purchase and actually needing money by more than 4 months. Now, maybe there is a finance bro justification about the time value of money here, but let's be honest. People are either doing this because they are incredibly financially irresponsible, or because they have no other choice. The cost of living has outpaced most people's incomes. Eventually, this is going to catch up with us. But for now, people are stretching things out for as long as they can using financial gymnastics like this. Buy now, pay later has become just another tool to delay the inevitable. According to an industry survey conducted by LendingTree, one of the fastest growing purchase markets for these services is in groceries. So yeah, it's easy to characterize people using services like Afterpay as reckless consumers. And there certainly are people being irresponsible. But a lot of this excess spending is really just people who couldn't afford to keep up. Even back in the good old days of 2023, a study conducted by the Fed found that more than half of BNPL users took on these loans because it was the only way they could afford it. So yeah, people spending money that they shouldn't or couldn't spend is a powerful incentive for businesses to accept the massive commission that these companies charge for their services.
Is this stuff regulated, or are you guys, what are you doing here?
Sort of?
Jesus Christ, the spread on these is huge.
50% commission?
Yep.
For what?
It's our markup for our services.
Anyway, if all of that wasn't good enough, these services collect a lot of data on their customers and act as a sales platform for brand partners, pushing deals and special time offers directly to individual consumers at specifically tailored times. In the early days of companies like Afterpay, they started out almost entirely as a sales platform, running events like Afterpay Day where partner retailers could run sales in a big online event. This has become less of a priority as the companies are now first and foremost a payment provider, but they still use it as a way to justify their business as a sales driver instead of just a fee generator. Klarna was once valued at over $45 billion, and investors didn't care as much about profitability problems because there was the potential for incredible profit if they became the default payment choice for a new generation. But that hasn't happened. The money these companies raised was primarily used to fund research and development, server hosting, salaries, and fancy offices with ping pong tables. But by now, hopefully, you are seeing the problem. The money that actually got lent to people didn't come from investors in the business. It was borrowed from institutional lenders and then loaned out to customers. Now, this isn't unusual. It's the fundamental system behind all banking. But good middlemen should be able to get more from this group than they need to pay back to this group. The problem is, these services suck at lending. Picking on Klarna again, because they are one of the few companies that have had to publicly release their financials so far, they have made $182 million in interest income in the first quarter of this year, coming from people who missed payments and had to pay penalties. In exchange, they had to pay $130 million in financing costs, which sounds like they should have made more than $50 million in gross profit just from lending. Except that people who are paying interest on late BNPL loans are not exactly the best borrowers. The company also lost an additional $136 million in loans that it considers unrecoverable. This means they actually lost about $85 million in one quarter, with a generous interpretation of their consumer losses. Credit cards aren't perfect by comparison, but banks are slightly more careful with who they will lend to. Banks can also raise cash at lower interest rates from individual depositors, and they can make money off people who aren't delinquent by definition. For a business that's predatory, they kind of suck at being predatory. For particularly desperate consumers, these businesses have become an alternative to payday lenders who also have similarly low lending standards. The only difference is that payday lenders charge exorbitant interest rates that made up for the risks and then some. Buy now, pay later companies can't really do that, because that would further tarnish their reputation as a fun little alternative to hashtag treat yourself and think about the problems later. With such huge losses from the lending side, it means BNPL companies are even more reliant on their merchant fees to keep them afloat, but companies are starting to push back on that. In order to be the exclusive provider to companies like Walmart and DoorDash, Klarna had to arrange sweetheart deals with much lower fees to these big companies. This might be a good play for taking market share, but even total domination of an unfeasible market doesn't mean much. Investors are likely to keep throwing money at these companies because if they can be the last one standing, there is the possibility of increasing margins. But that's going to come with some trade-offs for everybody else. the same way that Uber started out as a great alternative to taxis, Airbnb an alternative to hotels, and Netflix an alternative to cable, BNPL are still in the take market share phase. Eventually, these companies will need to make their service worse and take in more revenue if they want to continue existing. For businesses, that will mean more fees for the privilege of accommodating BNPL services. And for customers, it will most likely mean more hidden ways to be forced into paying more than you really wanted to. There are really no winners here, but nobody wants to be the biggest loser holding the bag if it all falls apart, a tragically common occurrence with a lot of new business trends. In fact, buy now, pay later is just the latest symptom of a bigger investment sickness. The biggest companies that you never heard of make billions of dollars every year by inserting themselves as wholesalers, distributors, licensors, or aggregators, getting between you and the factories that make your stuff. The only problem is, everybody kind of hates middlemen, which is why entire industries have been created from the ground up to cut them out. By offering direct-to-consumer, peer-to-peer, direct-selling, disruptive, streamlined outlet platform solutions to make consuming everything an easier, faster, and cheaper experience. The only problem is, it never really works. And in our venture capital-fueled rush to cut out the middlemen, we have just created even bigger ones.
Simply put, we cut out the middlemen. So we design our own frames. We work directly with manufacturers.
Yeah, we cut out the middleman and voila!
Uber on Monday said it's cutting 3,000 more jobs in a second wave of layoffs.
More and more Americans are cutting out the middleman in the prescription drug industry.
We cut out all of the middlemen.
No wholesalers, no middlemen, no distributors, no importers, just direct to your front door.
So last month, the online coupon code extension Honey was exposed for basically being a massive fraud that would claim referral revenue from its users' online shopping even if they found no coupons to offer and even if shoppers were directed to the website from another affiliate that actually did most of the work of selling them that product. They inserted themselves as a useless middleman and allegedly claimed billions of dollars in referral revenue. Now, unless you are living under a rock, you have probably already heard all about this. The original expose video has over 15 million views, and basically every major influencer on the platform has come out to call it the biggest scam in YouTube history. It's a big claim, considering large YouTube sponsors have given unlicensed mental health advice, leaked people's personal data, frozen their life savings, or misappropriated their investments. Hot take alert, but a multimillionaire like Linus not getting his referral revenue from Amazon is simply not as big of a deal as someone losing their life savings on a bank they were told to sign up for by a trusted finfluencer. Now, this is not to defend Honey in any capacity. What they did was clearly highly unethical at best, and will probably be proved fraudulent in the many upcoming court battles headed their way. But you would be forgiven for thinking that the reason it's getting so much attention from YouTubers is because this sponsor was stealing from the YouTubers themselves. The art of good business is being a good middleman. All of the biggest channels on this platform are made possible because at some point they may be able to convince you to buy something. That means they can directly or indirectly be rewarded for that through advertising. The reason this has rustled so many jimmies is because someone beat them at their own game, even if they weren't playing fair. Now, in the interest of total transparency, this channel is just as reliant on advertising to pay our team as the other big creators. And while we don't take sponsorships from financial firms because of the potential for you to lose your entire life savings, we honestly probably would have worked with Honey if we were offered because just like anybody else, we didn't see anything wrong with them. So, alright, with that out of the way, this video is not about the Honey scam in particular. It's about what it represents. If you buy something like this stylish personal neck fan off Amazon, Amazon itself doesn't actually sell the product. It just provides a marketplace and distribution services to a third-party distributor. That third-party distributor buys these products from an Alibaba wholesaler in China who themselves work with white-label suppliers who work with manufacturers. Even for a relatively simple piece of consumer junk, there were 5 middlemen between you and the person actually making that stuff. If you include an affiliate link in there, there's 6 different businesses that need to be paid, cutting into the profits or more likely raising the price of what could be a simple exchange. Consumer retail isn't even the worst example. Consultants, brokers, and fund managers and technology platforms have all built some of the most lucrative businesses in history by capitalizing on the golden age of the middleman. But why is this happening now? Middlemen are nothing new, but there are a few reasons why it's become particularly lucrative in just the last 2 decades. The first reason is we have simply mandated middlemen. The list of corporate regulations only grows longer every year, and so too do industry guidelines, best practices, frameworks, reporting standards, certifications, privacy controls, and self-imposed goals like ESG, DEI, CSR, GEP, GRC, and whatever other BS McKinsey cooks up in the new year. Some of these rules are absolutely necessary and genuinely help both consumers and workers. Some of them are just a little bit silly, and some of them only exist to make sure that a group can make money by consulting on the issues they create, looking at you, car dealerships. But either way, there are a lot of rules that businesses have to adhere to. Out of this, it's become very lucrative to provide third-party solutions that offload compliance onto another company that is better handled to deal with it. This both protects businesses from legal repercussions and lets them focus on where they actually add value in their business. Visa and MasterCard are some of the most valuable companies in the world, and their business operates exclusively on middlemaning transactions between credit card processors like Stripe or Square and banks who are themselves middlemen between the customer and the business that they are buying from. Businesses could just take cash or work out their own payment system, but it's just way easier to pay a few cents to Visa to process the transaction and let them handle the accounting, computing, and dispute resolution. It's also not like businesses have much of an option. When was the last time you paid in cash for anything? Lock your answer in the comments below. Of course, a small group of people live and die by the Benjamins, but the vast majority of consumer spending these days is done with credit cards, debit cards, or more recently, buy now, pay later services. Beyond letting people spend money they don't have, they are just easier. Any business that didn't want to work with these middlemen would immediately make it very difficult for most of their potential customers to shop with them. Now, this isn't a problem by itself. Modern payment providers have made doing business a lot easier for everybody, and they should be rewarded for providing that service. But as things like this get more complicated, every extra step of the supply, payment, or marketing process is an opportunity for a business to gain market power and squeeze out a little bit more from consumers. Even benign payment providers with lots of competition are causing a long list of problems for consumers, but that's got nothing on what the middlemen are doing to regular workers. To kick off the new year, a lot of people have been talking about H-1B skilled worker visas. These are something we have talked about a lot on this channel before, because they give companies the opportunity to employ workers from overseas if they can't find any workers in America willing to do the same job. Those foreign workers are then dependent on their employer to maintain their residency, which makes them great employees, because they really can't quit unless they find another company willing to sponsor them. A lot of companies, especially tech companies, clearly prefer these workers because they have more staff loyalty and won't argue too hard for a pay increase. The rules and restrictions on these visas are pretty extensive, and the rules are supposed to stop companies undercutting American workers and just hiring more subservient expat workers instead. But it's really easy for big companies to get around. If you are the CEO of a tech company and don't want to pay tech developer money for your engineers, just put up a job posting paying well below market rates. When nobody wants the job, you can then claim that you need to access someone with distinguished merit since nobody in America can fill your role. It's a broken system that's not great for American workers who get undercut for jobs, expats who get exploited by the companies they rely on, and genuine immigrants trying to earn their way into the country. But it's great for your bottom line. The problem for you is that companies are only allowed to hire so many H-1B workers. So a new industry has developed where large consulting firms will hire as many H-1B workers as they can. Tech companies like Google, Meta, and X are getting a lot of attention for their exploitation of these programs. But according to the Department of Immigration records compiled by the New York Times, the largest H-1B sponsors have actually been middleman firms that bill out their consultants hourly. This report was initially published over a decade ago, but more recent data still shows that distinguished labor hire agencies have learned to game the system. This lets companies offload the legal and reputational risk of using these workers onto the middlemen consulting firms, and even with a small premium for their services, it's still cheaper than paying market rates for technical skills. But the regulations arms race is only the first reason why we have entered the golden age of the middleman. A long time ago, in an economy far, far away, the closest thing we had to businesses producing products for consumption were smiths, saddlers, cobblers, and other ye olde tradesmen. These workers made things by hand only after an order was placed with them. Given their basic tools and lack of production lines, they didn't have an abundance of goods that they had to worry about finding a buyer for. They just made enough to keep up with orders. This really changed with the Industrial Revolution, and true mass production where consumer goods could be made faster than people could buy them. Over time, the modern business model of a manufacturer selling to a wholesaler who sold to a retailer who sold to a customer started to emerge, because it worked. Before this turns into a How History Works video, every step of this process has a part to play in making sure commerce is conducted smoothly. There have been hundreds of startup companies that have sold themselves on using a direct-to-consumer model to cut out the middleman. Even the biggest direct-to-consumer startups with the most investor money, like Casper Mattresses, Bonobos Tailored Clothing, Movement Watches, and Everlane Fashion, have either faced significant financial difficulties, been acquired by a traditional retailer, or gone out of business entirely. The YouTube channel Modern MBA did a great deep dive on Casper Mattresses in particular, analytically pulling apart their broken business model. If you're interested in thorough business analytics, I'll leave a link to his channel below. The point is, effective middlemen don't actually make businesses less efficient. If anything, they actually make the whole process too efficient. The manufacturer's job is to make stuff as efficiently as possible. The wholesaler buys from the manufacturer in advance to make sure that they have consistent cash flows. And the retailer handles customer service and sales, but relies on the wholesaler to make sure goods are available to sell. The wholesaler may look like a useless middleman, but they are a buffer to make sure that manufacturers don't have to worry about who they are going to sell their junk to, and retailers don't have to worry about not having enough junk to sell. That's the idea, anyway. Some companies are big enough that they can be both the retailer and the wholesaler, which is why Walmart and other big box stores will be able to outcompete local independent retailers. Now, eventually, these companies figured out that it's cheaper to do the manufacturing offshore, which meant supply chains got longer and more complicated, making the job of the wholesaler even more important, and potentially more profitable. Today, the only retailers that can really compete on value are major corporations that integrate wholesale into their operations, or get around it altogether. This has given them more market power over both producers and consumers because the barriers to entry into these markets has become so much steeper. We aren't living in the golden age of middlemen because there are more of them. In fact, it's actually because there are less of them. They just have a lot more power. Big companies have realized it's a lot easier to gain market power as a middleman than as someone who deals with the end consumer. Catherine Judge is a law professor at Columbia and published the book Direct: The Rise of the Middleman Economy and the Revolution Underway. In her book, she outlines how technology, globalization, and financialization have all worked hand in hand to allow a small group of companies to become middlemen in business operations that just weren't possible that long ago. In particular, she focuses on the collection of data as a tool that is uniquely useful to middlemen, because being right in the middle of operations means they can access information from both suppliers and consumers. Effectively leveraging data is an incredibly powerful tool to reduce costs on one side of the business and maximize sales on the other. Even if you ran a business that could somehow supply products with the same economies of scale as Amazon and Walmart, you would still find it incredibly difficult to compete with them because they have so much data about when to order stock, where to build retail stores and distribution centers, how many drivers need to work a particular route, when people are most likely to make a purchase, and what items should be presented to them first as they log in or walk into a location. It's all data, and being the biggest middleman in their respective fields allows them to collect more of it and use it in more ways. Other companies can purchase data from data brokers, or even use select meta-analytics provided by the big tech companies, but it's never going to be as comprehensive, detailed, or as deep as the good stuff they keep for themselves. The final point that Judge makes is lobbying power. These companies can argue for more or less regulation in the fields that are important to them extremely effectively. Votes over boring middlemen regulations barely get lawmakers to show up, let alone get the interest of the general public. So this is amongst the most effective ways for these companies to lobby. Now, the solution to this problem is the same solution to a lot of problems in corporate America. Clamp down hard on companies with too much market power, especially those that are not as obvious as the Googles and Facebooks of the world. There is one industry that has taken this middleman process to the extreme, and that is finance. Private equity and broad asset managers have become some of the most powerful middlemen in history. If you pay any attention to financial news, you have probably heard the same line every time the stock market has a little whoopsie-daisy.
$58 billion wiped off the exchange today.
$136 billion was wiped off.
$5 trillion in value had been wiped from the markets in just 3 weeks.
Yeah, that's right. Every time green line does not go up, we are told some company or the market has lost, destroyed, or wiped out however many billions of dollars. But all right then, where does that money actually go? It might not surprise you to learn that headlines like this are written more for shock and awe than genuine insight. But the simple truth is that the money doesn't actually go anywhere, because it never existed in the first place. Sort of. If you can look beyond the flashy headlines like this and actually understand what they are trying to say, you are going to be much better equipped to make sensible financial decisions when everybody else is busy losing their minds and, if they are lucky enough, maybe even their retirement savings too. This basic understanding has probably actually never been more important than it is right now, because the stock market is breaking new records every single week. Nobody knows if or when the party will stop. But what we do know is that, in this particular case, the money doesn't actually have anywhere else to go.
$5 trillion in value had been wiped from the markets in just 3 weeks.
Gold prices hit a record high on Tuesday.
The dream of owning the house with the white picket fence increasingly giving way to white picket renters.
You could buy a house tomorrow if the price was right, if the interest rates were where they needed to be.
Help for the economy from Washington remains nowhere in sight.
So there are really three different levels of technical explanation for what happens to money during a crash. The good enough for most people level, the armchair market analyst level, and then the level that considers debt, consumption, and all the different asset markets that are getting kind of weird at the moment. Now, most people don't even get level one right, but I promise none of this is as complicated as the financial bros would like you to think. And actually seeing how these markets work is the only way to understand how messed up they really are at the moment. But alright, most of the time when headlines are talking about billions of dollars being destroyed or whatever, what they are really saying is that the market capitalization of a company or group of companies has been repriced. This is just calculated using the number of outstanding shares multiplied by the price the last share was traded at. So for example, Nvidia currently has about 24 billion outstanding shares, and right now those shares are trading at a price of about $170, which gives the company a market cap of $4.1 trillion. If for some reason tomorrow people decided to start trading Nvidia shares at $85, then it would have the market cap of the company and you would inevitably see headlines about Nvidia losing $2 trillion. But they didn't really lose $2 trillion. They were just revalued using this very crude calculation. Now, technically, this could actually help Nvidia's ongoing business operations. Since the AI boom, the company has been doing a lot of share buybacks, where they will use their profits to buy company stock off existing shareholders to take it out of circulation. They are only supposed to do this when management thinks the company is undervalued. So if their stock halves in price, they will get twice as many shares for the same money, which should be a good thing, right? Well, this is assuming, of course, that they aren't just doing stock buybacks to drive up an already hyped up stock. Part of what is making the current stock market so strange at the moment is that by far the biggest net purchaser of shares in these companies are these companies. According to the Fed's Z1 financial accounts, households made net purchases of about $100 billion of stock in 2024. This was dwarfed by listed corporations that did over $625 billion worth of net buying, meaning that companies were buying six times more of their own stock than actual stockholders were. Now, that doesn't seem great, but it's actually worse than it sounds. The whole point of a stock market is that it's supposed to be a place where companies can go and sell their shares to raise money to fund business operations. This net sales figure also includes the company subtracting from this net number by conducting IPOs. The total gross value of stock buybacks was over $1 trillion within 2024 alone. It just so happens that companies also raised about $375 billion in the same year. Now, this has helped to increase market capitalization by driving up share prices, but that's not even the biggest problem. It will actually get more important later on as we go into how asset markets are supposed to function. But for now, for level one, a market crash is just a readjustment in market capitalization. Unless a company is planning to sell its own stock to raise money to fund future projects, its day-to-day market capitalization shouldn't impact its performance. Market capitalization is kind of like GDP. It's a number that we use a lot because it's sort of easy to calculate, and it's good enough as a rough indication of if things are going in the right direction or not. Now, a lot of people, when they learn this, take it to mean that market cap is irrelevant. A $10 banana is no better than a banana that's on clearance for $5. And while that's true, a sudden price drop on anything can be an indication that there is something rotting away beneath the surface. So, for the next level of understanding, you need to do what the journalists writing the headlines aren't willing to do, and actually follow the money. Now, I know I just said that if a stock halves in value, that doesn't necessarily mean that any money has gone anywhere. But in highly liquid markets, such a scenario can only really happen one way. The NASDAQ doesn't get to slap a 50% off clearance label on Nvidia stock like Walmart does on questionable milk. The way the price moves in these kinds of markets is that if there are more sellers than buyers, the price falls, and if there are more buyers than sellers, the price rises. When people are panic selling stocks, they are still getting money in exchange for those stocks. It may not be as much as they wanted, but what they then do with that money is where things get interesting. Let's say you had some spare money. Yeah, I know, but just pretend with me for a second. With your pile of cash, you have some options. You can invest into the stock market, real estate, bonds, gold, alternatives like cryptocurrency, or you could just hold on to your cash. Alternatively, if you just want to enjoy your life right now, you could spend that money on goods and services like a new car, a bigger house to live in, or a nice vacation. All of these activities that improve your quality of life are generally classified as consumption. Depending on where you and everybody else who has spare money puts their cash, it will increase the value of these markets. So if everybody buys gold, its price will increase as demand increases on an asset with limited supply. Now, stocks, bonds, and real estate are kind of unique because they generate their own cash flow to give money back to you. Stocks do this through dividends, bonds through interest, and real estate through rent. Those cash flows come from other people deciding to put their money into the consumption pile, which becomes revenue for these three asset classes. But all of these other assets really only make returns by having more people buy in at a progressively higher price. When the stock market crashes, what is really happening is everybody trying to grab their cash out of that particular asset market. They do this either because they think the market won't generate as much cash flow in the future, or more often, just to get their cash out before everybody else lowers their price by taking their cash out. Now, if you were lucky enough to get your cash back before everybody else, you have a choice. During a lot of market crashes, people just want to hold on to their cash because they are afraid they will lose their jobs and nothing else is generating cash flow. But eventually, you will need to put your money somewhere. And that predicament is what is creating such a big problem right now. Sure, maybe you think that the stock market might be an AI-fueled bubble. But if you sell your positions, where exactly should you put your money? Gold is at all-time highs. Real estate is risky with today's interest rates. Cryptocurrency is highly correlated with the stock market. Goods and services are more expensive than ever, and people are even starting to question the long-term safety of the bond market. People are quickly running out of safe platforms to stand on, which has got a few people saying that maybe these markets aren't actually broken. Maybe it's the money that's broken. The way that money flows in and out of these markets can have a big impact on the way that you live your life, even if you don't actually have that much in any one of these respective piles. Increasing housing prices have become a defining financial problem of young generations as people can't afford a place to start their own lives or their own families. House prices have outpaced inflation by a lot, which I know is not exactly shocking to most of you, especially if you have watched any of the dozens of videos we have made about the structural problems and broken incentives in the housing market. But the key here is that when we measure price increases relative to inflation, we are only measuring relative to the consumption pile here with the consumer price index. The problem with this is that it doesn't reflect the changing gaps between these other money piles. Real estate, for example, has grown faster than consumer prices, but relative to fixed assets like gold, it's actually gone backwards. An article published by Jonathan Hobbs, a chartered financial analyst, compiled this data to show that if you were paying for the average American house today in gold, you would be spending about half as much as you would have been back in 1991, and roughly a quarter of what you would have been paying in the early 2000s. Now, the article itself used this data to build a case for just buying gold. But the reality is basically any assets would have had the same effect. If you were paying in S&P 500 indexes, the relative fall in house prices would have been even greater. So there are two lessons from this. One is that investing is important. I hope you already knew that. But the deeper lesson here is that it's become much easier for people with lots of money in these piles to buy basically anything they want from these piles. There is only so much money that people can spend on consumption, so wealthy people naturally throw the rest into one of these. As they have grown, they have provided more money to people who own them, and since most of them were already maxing out what they could throw into consumption, they put even more back into these piles, creating a feedback loop of wealth generation. A basic look at the historic numbers makes this pretty clear. Market returns over the past 60 years have averaged just over 10%, and inflation has averaged just over 4%. If you include taxes, this generally means if you can consume less than 4% of your invested assets annually, you can live forever without touching your principal. This basic arithmetic is the foundation of things like the financial independence retire early movement. But for extremely wealthy people who can easily afford to live on less than 4% of their net worth, they can compound wealth faster than they can spend it. Now compare this to most people who earn their income by selling their time. Most wage increases are indexed to consumer prices, if you are lucky, which has been the slowest growing one of these piles. This has made it harder and harder for the wages to compete when both groups want to put their money into the same area. A lot of what the wealthy are buying is different from what working people are buying, but there are some areas where these cross over. Real estate is just the most obvious and socially destabilizing example of that. The reason this is happening now is that the growth in these asset piles has become unprecedented. We have been paying a lot of attention to what the money printer has done to consumer prices, but these other money piles have soaked up much of the excess cash and it has put non-asset owners further behind. Now, the point of this is not that inequality has become worse, you already knew that, but a new problem coming from that is how these increasingly consolidated markets are behaving. According to the Fed, participation in the stock market is approaching all-time highs, which sounds like a good thing. But this has mainly been driven by lots of people investing very small amounts of money through platforms with low fees and low barriers to entry, like Robinhood. The real money in these asset markets is more consolidated than it has ever been, with the top 10% of households owning 93% of all equities the last time this data was collected at the end of 2024. In a market panic, the reason why people sell their assets is because they want to make sure they have enough cash on hand to cover their most basic consumption needs if they lose their source of income, which for most people is their job. Unfortunately, job losses and market downturns often go hand in hand. However, as these assets have become more consolidated amongst people who can easily cover their living expenses several times over, there have consistently been more people with lots of spare cash to buy in versus the people that need to sell out to cover themselves in a hard time. Put another way, if unemployment was to hypothetically spike tomorrow for any particular reason, most of the people losing their jobs would not have a meaningful pile of assets to sell to cover themselves while they were looking for a new job. And it's not like we would miss the consumers either. A majority of the consumer spending in the economy now comes from the top 10% of households, and corporate profits are primarily driven by selling stuff to other corporations. Sounds pretty bad, right? Well, it gets worse. Remember those record-setting stock buybacks from earlier? Well, they have outnumbered net household share purchases 6-1, adding even more people to the side piling money in. If you add this to the rise of index funds that mindlessly buy and hold a broad selection of shares, it's easy to see how lopsided the market has become. Now, this does not mean that markets can't fall, but what it does mean is that they can stretch far further and stay irrational far longer than they could ever before, and while they do, they are throwing off money like never before for people to buy up every other asset market. Sounds pretty bad, right? Well, it gets worse. A huge amount of this money recently has been tied up in chasing returns from AI. These companies have spent trillions of dollars on this project, so far. Late last week, everybody's least favorite tech priest T-Rex, Sam Altman, said the quiet part out loud when he suggested that AI and the industry surrounding it might be in a bit of a bubble. This simultaneously shocked absolutely everyone and absolutely nobody at the same time. The value of the entire stock market has nearly doubled over the last 5 years. This has been driven almost entirely by just 10 companies, whose growth was in turn driven almost entirely by the promise of AI. Most people understand that this isn't sustainable, but they also understand that technology like this has changed the world before. Improvements are slowing down as new models are showing disappointing improvements, but every day we are discovering new things we can do with these products. For every argument, there is a counterargument. You don't need to watch another video speculating about the future of AI, because the truth is nobody has a damn clue. But what we can do is look back over these last 3 years and find out how much this whole game has cost us, because the numbers are not good.
It's almost like investors are saying $100 million isn't enough, Deirdre, make it two.
And we're told that Zuckerberg at that time really said, okay,
I'm thrilled we get to do this in the United States of America. I think this will be the most important project of this era.
The dormant nuclear reactors at Three Mile Island, because decades after a partial reactor meltdown shut down part of the facility.
Okay, so everybody has been paying a lot of attention to the astronomical valuations that have been assigned to everything even partially AI related, and they have also been paying attention to billions of dollars in value vanishing into thin air whenever Jensen Huang sneezes the wrong way. Now, to be fair, we kind of have to pay attention to it, because that's all of our retirement savings tied up in this fun little game. But all of this value probably means a lot less than you think. Market capitalization, which is what most AI headlines focus on, is simply a calculation of how many shares are in circulation multiplied by what number the last speculator in line made a trade at. If Nvidia halves in value, that doesn't mean that $2 trillion has been destroyed. It just means we have put a new price tag on what this business does. Just like if Walmart marks down a banana from $10 to $5, it hasn't destroyed $5. The actual numbers we should be paying attention to are the actual resources that we have put into this system versus what we have gotten back out. And by resources, you can't just think of cash. Cash is really just the receipt for resources. So while dollars are a great unit to tally everything up, what we should instead be keeping track of is how many cold, hard, tangible, Age of Empire-style resources we have used to fuel this one particular tech tree. Because only then can we find out if this is really making the world a richer place. Alright, so how do we do that? Well, we can start from a simple analysis of the direct business expenses taken on by companies desperate to stay ahead of their competitors. And after that, we can work down to the less tangible stuff, like the opportunity cost of sanctioning China over AI chips or dedicating some of the world's best researchers to producing whatever the hell this is. The first major resource being used to fuel this machine is the most obvious one, all of those chips. In our Amazon video released just a month ago, the tally for AI capital expenditure amongst just four of the top tech companies had reached $200 billion for the year and $60 billion for the most recent reported quarter alone. But since that video went live, new filings have come out, and now, according to company reports collated by Bloomberg, spending for this year is already on track to hit $344 billion. That is more than 1% of America's entire GDP being used building compute infrastructure to develop and operate new models. Now, if this sounds just a little bit dumb to you, don't worry. It's actually worse than you think. For one thing, this number only includes the top four tracked public firms: Meta, Google, Microsoft, and the biggest spender of all, Amazon. Smaller businesses or private companies like OpenAI are not included in these numbers because they don't have to release financial information. But from the outside, we can still make some educated guesses. The scale and frequency of fundraising taking place at OpenAI, the makers of ChatGPT, is growing exponentially every year, even as they have started squeezing out revenue. In March this year, the company received $40 billion from investors in the largest private tech deal in history. And then, just 4 months later, they raised another $8.3 billion. Every time they do this, their existing investors are giving up some of their stake in the company. So the only reason they would go ahead with it is if they really needed the money, which they do, mostly to keep on building new compute capacity. The second reason the spending is probably even worse than it looks has a lot to do with accounting. Capital expenditure just means businesses spending money on fixed assets like land, vehicles, and in this instance, gigantic data centers. For the accountants, this distinction is important, because if a company makes $1 million in gross profit and then spends $1 million buying a building, it doesn't get to subtract the total purchase from its revenue up front like it would if it spent $1 million on a regular expense like salaries. Instead, they have to use a depreciation schedule, which accounts for how much value an item loses with every year of use in line with industry standards. For server equipment, that is 5 years, which means if a company spent $1 million on a fancy new rack of NVIDIA GPUs, they would only be able to claim $200,000 a year as actual expenses against their taxes. Normally, companies want to maximize this appreciation to minimize their tax liability, artificially making things look worse in the business than they actually are, as far as the IRS is concerned. But right now, they are kind of doing the opposite. Chips that were state-of-the-art in 2022, when ChatGPT first launched, are almost completely useless in today's modern AI data centers and are largely not even worth the energy to run. It's highly unlikely that the billions of dollars in chips that they are buying right now are going to take 5 years to fully depreciate, even though that is what it's going to say on their official financial statements. This treadmill of technology has created a higher level of spending than any other project in history. And what is easy to forget with all of these insane numbers being thrown around is that these are resources that could have been used elsewhere. One way that you could interpret these numbers is that the rapidly escalating AI arms race has become an incredibly efficient machine that turns investor dollars into e-waste with a byproduct of brain rot. But maybe we are getting ahead of ourselves. So far, total spending on just this technical hardware alone has amounted to around $1 trillion by just these four companies. According to data from Stanford, Chinese state-owned enterprises have invested an additional $500 billion into AI infrastructure. And then, every other organization in the world that isn't Amazon, Meta, Google, or Microsoft has dropped in another $500 trillion working backwards off the sales data from NVIDIA and AMD. But that's just the first item on the budget sheet. And these companies are finding out the hardware is the cheap part. The costs of getting AI to where it is now have already been staggering. But when you do a cost-benefit analysis, it's also important to look at, well, the benefits. The only problem is, those benefits have been surprisingly hard to find. A report by MIT tracked 300 companies implementing generative AI into their workflows on an enterprise level. Despite an additional $30 to $40 billion of investment, which we can add to the tally, the study found that 95% of the organizations generated zero returns from AI. Now, for what it's worth, I would like to say that I don't want to completely write off AI, even though I know it's sometimes really easy to hate on how it's being sold to the world. AI, like most new technologies, is coming along with a bit too much hype, but underneath that, there are some cool things you can do with it. I know I have used this example before, but even here at Little Ol' Works Media Group, we used to spend hours every week cutting out images to use as assets in our videos. Now, most of that can be done with AI tools letting our editors actually work on something creative, or, you know, just getting some time to go out and touch grass. These are real practical tools that have helped make someone's working day easier, more productive, and less monotonous. The problem with this, though, is that when companies, governments, and nonprofit organizations have poured trillions of dollars into developing this technology, useful practical tools are not good enough. Companies want to be able to replace their workforce, not make their work slightly easier. Governments want a superintelligence, not something that can trim out JPEGs. And honestly, I don't even want to know what someone like Peter Thiel wants.
You would prefer the human race to endure, right? You're hesitating.
Yeah, well,
Yes?
I don't know. I would... Yes.
Okay.
But whatever these grand ambitions end up being, the bill is adding up. And we haven't even got to the big expense yet. Energy. Earlier this month, a group of AI researchers started making headlines after they returned from a tour of facilities in China. Their claim was that America had probably already lost the AI arms race, not because China had better technology or researchers, but because they had an actual functional electric grid. According to the Department of Energy in a report, the foundation of America's electrical grids were built in the 1960s and 70s, and a lot of the infrastructure is still being used today, well past the end of its intended life cycle. China has industrialized much more recently than we have here in America. So while our grid is barely holding on, they have had the advantage of practically building theirs from scratch with more modern technology. Now, this still hasn't been cheap for them. But since the 1990s, while America's economy has been primarily fueled by consumer spending, China's has grown on exports and construction. According to their national statistics and corroborated by Bloomberg Intelligence, the country spent nearly $2.3 trillion on infrastructure in 2022 alone, compared to $1.1 trillion worth of spending in the US, spread out over 5 years. This is not to say what China is doing is a good idea either. This kind of spending has put them in a potentially ruinous amount of debt. But the reason this is important for the AI discussion is because Chinese grids frequently run with energy reserve margins of 100%, which means it has twice the energy capacity it needs, whereas in America, we operate with margins of just 15%, according to the researchers who made this report. That means that AI data centers in China are actually a useful way to soak up extra energy capacity, while the same facilities here in America are a strain on already crumbling infrastructure. The International Energy Agency estimates that data centers accounted for 1.5% of the world's electricity consumption in 2024, and is projected to double by 2030 if current trends continue with AI. If you were to get that out of your outlet at home, 450 terawatt hours spread out over the last 3 years only would have cost you around $18 billion, assuming you were able to negotiate wholesale rates of about $40 per megawatt hour. That's actually not bad, but it's far from the whole story. That's just the cost that the AI operators will pay, not everybody else. You've probably noticed that your electricity has become more expensive over recent months. Or maybe you haven't because, let's be honest, everything has become more expensive over recent months. But anyway, I want to play a little game. This is average energy prices across American cities according to the BLS. Can you see anything that stands out? Let me give you a hint. Major AI development really kicked off right here. Now, the war in Ukraine, more EVs, and overall inflation played a part in this too. But here in America, we never really relied on Russian energy. Before the recent surge in AI, electricity prices were actually declining compared to inflation. But now they've almost doubled within the last 3 years alone. This is costing us all in more ways than just the big, beautiful energy bills we have to deal with every month. Other industries like manufacturing also use a lot of energy, and if they have to pay twice as much for this crucial input, they are going to pass those costs along to all of us and be less competitive in global markets. According to the Energy Information Administration, end-use electricity expenditures totaled $419 billion in 2021 before this jump. They have not published data on 2024 yet, but if we are using more electricity and paying almost twice as much for it, the actual cost felt across the economy is easily an additional $400 billion. Again, this is just in America. Now, some of the largest AI players have responded to these market conditions by just commissioning their own power plants. But other businesses are pursuing a more tried and tested approach, begging the government to fix their problems for them. Big tech companies have been lobbying hard to get money allocated to upgrade energy infrastructure. They are using the threat of moving their operations offshore if their needs aren't met, which is an effective message since the government sees this as such a strategic industry. Now, if we end up getting a better electrical grid because some big tech companies wanted it, maybe that might actually be an example of political lobbying accidentally doing some good. But according to the University of Texas Energy Institute report, this could take trillions of dollars, and nobody is arguing that the grid doesn't need an upgrade. The problem is that nobody else is getting a say as to whether there are better places to be spending that money first. Places like, oh, I don't know, bailing out private equity when they inevitably explode. 20 years ago, if you asked the average person what they thought about private equity, they would probably have no idea what you were talking about. The business was a small, unglamorous, and overlooked side of finance that people went into if they couldn't land a job at a hedge fund where the real money was made. Since then, though, changes in regulations, investor preferences, and the availability of cash has allowed the industry to grow to over 20 times its size back in 2000. In that time, it minted dozens of billionaires, acquired millions of businesses, developed a bad reputation, and simply grown too big for its own good. The thing that originally made private equity a competitive investment was its small size and understated operations. But not unlike a parasite that has outgrown its host, the biggest threat to private equity today is private equity. Deals are getting harder to find, fees are getting harder to justify, and returns are simply not worth the risk. Now, I know that you might think this sounds like a problem for wealthy investors and asset managers, not you. But the whole system only works by borrowing a lot of money through business structures that look like this and assuming that things will keep growing forever. If that doesn't happen, there are now trillions of dollars in loans that could go bad. And I'm sorry to be the one to tell you, but that is going to be a problem for you. So if private equity has become such a bad investment, who keeps on giving them money?
What do you do out here in New York City?
I'm in finance.
Like what exactly?
Private equity.
What is the most amount of money you made in a single year?
Half a million.
Yeah.
Companies that are owned by private equity firms are significantly more likely to go bankrupt.
The endless shrimp is not the reason Red's Lobster is in bankruptcy. The fundamental problem is that Red's Lobster got involved in what's called private equity.
You can't keep doing that. You know why? Because the ratio of the debt of the United States has become unsustainable.
Okay, so a quick refresher on what private equity is and how it actually works. Private equity simply means any investment made into businesses or assets that are not listed on public securities markets. Technically, if you invest a few thousand dollars into a local cafe, you are a private equity investor. Now, what actually brings all the boys in sleeveless vests to the yard are dedicated private equity funds that raise money from a pool of high-profile investors and use that to buy entire businesses, the so-called buyout funds. These kinds of private equity firms will take their investors' money, put in a little bit of their own, and then borrow as much as they can to fill up a pool of capital that they can then use to make acquisitions. Once they buy up a portfolio of real companies, producing real products, and generating real cash flows, they get those businesses to take out big loans to pay money back to them through a special dividend. This means that the founding partners of these firms can own billions of dollars worth of assets while only having invested a tiny fraction of their own money. But it doesn't stop there. The private equity company isn't actually responsible for any of the loans that its portfolio companies take out that begins and ends with the companies themselves. It's like if you own shares in Walmart, you aren't responsible for the company's loans if they fail to repay them. The most you can lose is the money you invested if your shares go to zero. In the case of private equity, what this lets them do is go back to a bank and show them a big portfolio of private businesses, which they can use as security to get you yet another loan. These are called net asset value loans, but since they are loans taken out against companies that already have loans, they are normally just called leverage on leverage, or leverage squared, which does sound familiar. Anyway, the debt doesn't stop there. Remember that money that the wealthy investors and private equity partners put in to get the whole firm started in the first place? Well, normally even that money is borrowed, because investment loans are a very tax-efficient way for wealthy investors to gain exposure to these firms. But it gets worse. One of the downsides of private equity is that, by definition, it's private, as in not listed on public markets. That means it can be difficult for investors to turn their holdings in the firm into cash when they need the money. Fortunately for them, there are firms that will buy stakes in private equity firms from investors called secondaries funds. Now, regulations actually prevent these secondary funds from using debt to fund their acquisitions. Except, of course, that's not true at all. Most of their purchases are indeed also financed with debt. So if you are keeping track, they will take on debt to buy a stake in a firm originally purchased with debt that was used as a down payment on more debt to buy a business that took on debt to deliver paper returns to a fund, which used those returns to qualify for more debt to buy more companies that could be used to take on more debt. But anyway, that's still not everything. So far, this kind of lending has been really profitable, which is why it's not just banks getting in on the action. Some private equity firms have specialized in just lending money to private companies and other private equity firms rather than acquiring the companies themselves. Now, that sly bastard Dan Toomey beat me to it again, but these private credit firms have exploded in scope and scale over the last decade, and they now have over $1.6 trillion in lending within the USA alone, according to data from Preqin, a financial research firm. The exact scale of this lending is hard to know exactly, because since these private credit firms are not officially banks, and they are lending to private companies with no public reporting obligations, it can be very hard to get reliable data. Now, you are never going to be able to guess where these private credit firms get their money to do this lending. Yeah, that's right. They borrow it. This endless cycle of leverage on leverage on leverage is why private equity has been able to scale so rapidly and generate so much money for the people working in all of these different organizations. But this money still had to come from somewhere. And statistically, it's come from you. It's now one of the widely accepted rules of investing that it's almost impossible to beat the returns of the market long term. There are once-in-a-generation exceptions to this, like Warren Buffett and Jim Simons, but they practically created totally new ways of investing from scratch. Endless backdated research has effectively found the same thing. Any investment managers that have outperformed the market in the past have done so almost entirely because they got lucky. Funds that get lucky generally outperform in the future and tend to underperform over the following years. This trend can actually be worse than straight-up gambling because it's a highly efficient way to destroy wealth. Now, the infamous Cathie Wood generated outstanding returns through her ARK Innovation Fund by basically going all in on one of the biggest hype stocks of all time. In particular, her outstanding performance in 2020 attracted a lot of investors to buy into the fund, right before it lost 70% of its value and has since delivered weak overall returns. Since its inception in 2014, the fund has delivered 200% returns, which is only slightly worse than the 226% the S&P returned over the same time period. But most ARK investors did not buy in back in 2014. They bought up here at peak hype, so even though the fund has performed okay overall, most investors are holding huge losses. On top of this, active investment managers charge fees for the privilege of managing your money, which further puts them statistically behind over the long term compared to a passive, diversified, low-cost index fund. The fees charged by private equity funds are generally some of the highest in the industry, sometimes charging clients 5 to 10 times more in fees than even regular actively managed funds, which means that in an efficient market, they would fall even further behind. Now, the rich people and institutional investors that give money to private equity managers know this. The research is not new, and it's been widely accepted for decades at this point. So then, who keeps giving private equity so much money? Well, hot take alert, but the original idea of private equity was actually really good. Now, I know a lot of you are furiously typing in the comments already, because yeah, private equity has turned into an incredibly destructive monolith, but it didn't start out like this. For investors, it actually could beat the market, because it had nothing to do with the market. Private equity didn't deal with listed companies, so it didn't have to compete with all the nerds on Wall Street that did mathematics PhDs at Penn to eke out 3 basis points of alpha. Instead of trying to find hidden value in terabytes of market data, private equity instead invested in smaller local businesses and actively added value by combining their business acumen with the skills of the previous owners. A lot of small business owners are really good at their craft, but they lack formal business training, so they don't optimize things like marketing, accounting, tax management, or expansion opportunities. In theory, the management teams from private equity could find these businesses, make their improvements, and maximize the returns of good, honest businesses to beat the market consistently. In the early days, this was not a job that finance bros wanted to be doing because instead of hanging out in Manhattan high-rises working on glamorous deals, they would be setting up bookkeeping software for a regional plumbing company in Ohio. Over time, people noticed that they could make a lot of money and charge a lot of fees for this kind of groundwork, which made it more attractive than even top investment banks or hedge funds. But this has started to change for 3 reasons. The first problem is that as the popularity of private equity has grown, it's become harder to find businesses worth buying. Back in the early days, when the industry was still in its infancy, small business owners would find it really difficult to sell their businesses because not many people have the capital and the expertise to run something like an HVAC company or a mechanic shop. Because of this, private equity firms could normally acquire a business for just 2 to 3 times their annual earnings, meaning even if they didn't make any improvements, they would theoretically be making strong returns just for maintaining operations. But as more firms got into the game, the people selling their businesses had more offers coming in, which meant new PE firms had to make bigger and bigger bids to secure acquisitions. According to First Page Sage, a research firm that collects data on this industry, the average HVAC company now sells for a multiple of between 5 and 10 times their earnings. Now, this data is really hard to collect, because the details of private equity business sales don't need to be publicly disclosed. This particular report is just a guesstimation based on network feedback, expert interviews, and internal databases. Even based on these rough numbers, a business that pays 10 years to cover its purchase price is no longer beating the market after fees and expenses, which means that private equity firms had to start pushing their portfolio companies harder to squeeze out more profit and then flip them for big capital gains. Now, for a while, this worked because of a fun little trick they could pull in a growing market. After private equity firms improved the businesses they acquired, they could sell it for a profit. And over time, the largest buyer of businesses sold by private equity firms were other private equity firms. Because new firms were paying more and more for acquisitions every year, this made returns look incredibly strong because they were literally pumping their own market. These strong returns attracted more investment and allowed private equity companies to take on more debt to buy more businesses, driving up prices, which created strong returns for the people who got in early. This little feedback loop generated incredible returns and made the long-term risks someone else's problem, so it incentivized the second problem. Once firms ran out of good, stable businesses with solid cash flows to acquire, they had to look for riskier options to pull the same trick with. That either meant paying more for businesses in good, stable industries or looking at questionable businesses in risky industries. It didn't really matter because the point was to flip them to the next buyer. As a random example, there is a good chance that some of your favorite YouTube channels are now owned by private equity firms. Look, YouTube channels can be great businesses, but they are just inherently riskier than something like an established carpentry company that has been operating for three generations. The race to find more businesses means that risks like these will become more common. The other problem with feedback loops is what happens when they start to go in the other direction. Over the last two decades, the conditions have been perfect for private equity to grow. Interest rates have been low, there were lots of businesses to acquire, and people wanted an alternative to real estate and the stock market. But that's changing. Baby boomers are aging out of their businesses in record numbers, which is putting more supply back onto the market. Small business owners are also more savvy than they were 20 years ago. Everything you would ever need to know about running a business effectively is available online, which means there isn't as much opportunity for the private equity Wharton grads to step in and make big improvements. And finally, people are just becoming more skeptical of the industry. New investments into private equity have plunged 35% this year, because people are realizing how hard it is to get their cash back out of the system. 2025 is on track to be the lowest fundraising year for private equity in over a decade. Unlike public stocks, it's really hard to tell how much private companies are actually worth until they are sold. What this has done is let private equity managers sell the businesses that have performed well and hold on to the businesses that have not. This makes fund performance look really good by realizing potential gains and hiding unrealized losses. But it also means that slowly, the portfolio fills up with bad underperforming businesses, and that can only be kept under wraps for so long. If enough investors stop investing, then private equity will lose their biggest buyers, which are other private equity firms. Another group that has been doing well are the secondaries firms. These were the firms that would buy stakes of private equity investors for a discount to give them liquidity when they needed it. In a surprising twist, some of the biggest groups getting out of private equity right now are colleges with large endowments. Harvard in particular has billions of dollars invested in private equity, and for some reason, it needs to raise a little bit of cash right now. So it's selling its stake to anybody that will buy it. If new investors can buy discounted shares and buy out firms from panic sellers, then there isn't really any reason why they would invest in a new fund without a discount. Now, that actually shouldn't be a problem. The firms could just focus on improving the businesses in their portfolio and accept slightly lower returns for a little while. The only problem is that great big web of debt from earlier. A lot of private equity firms need to keep flipping through businesses to maintain repayments to various lenders, and if nobody is buying, that can turn into a very big problem very quickly. Now, if there is any good news, it's that there is one niche of private credit that is doing very well. Distressed debt strategies have had their best year ever with over $21 billion raised for funds looking to make emergency loans to businesses going through bankruptcy. So, you know, that's a good sign. The bad news is that if this whole system falls apart, then trillions of dollars of bad loans are going to impact Main Street banks, pension funds, and regular people. A lot of this debt was securitized and turned into tranched bonds, which were then sold openly with various risk ratings. By layering the debt, private credit firms could offer low-risk, low-return bonds and high-risk, high-return bonds all from the same source of debt. By design, wealthy investors and the fund managers use a lot of debt because it means they don't actually have to invest that much of their own money to make big returns when things are doing well. But it also means that they don't stand to lose much if things fall apart either. Now, fortunately, this is not as big of a structural issue as mortgage-backed securities were in 2008. But if a PE slowdown can't be managed carefully, it could massively disrupt the market for small businesses, just like the subprime mortgage crisis disrupted the market for real estate. But wait, there's more. The last 2 years, the value of everything from G-Class Mercedes to Rolex Submariners, luxury handbags, and trading cards has taken a huge hit. Basically, if you saw a luxury product in a sketchy ad from some guy trying to sell you a dropshipping course, it's probably halved in value. If you are ever feeling bad about your own personal financial choices, go and watch finance brokers try to unwind someone who has $150,000 in negative equity on an electric Hummer that they purchased with an 8-year loan to rent out on Turo. It should make you feel much better. But I am sorry to tell you that these things might be starting to turn around for these douchebags. We are re-entering a market where Bitcoin is breaking all-time records, stonks are only going up, and Dogecoin is worth more than Nintendo, Delta Airlines, or the Ford Motor Company. In a market where prices only go up, you better brace yourself, because people are going to say that just about anything is an investment to convince their customers, to convince their partners, or just to convince themselves. But that doesn't matter, as long as they can't convince you.
That is how I could justify spending $11,000 on a first edition pack of Pokemon cards from Logan Paul.
That watches are actually not just fashion, not just a statement about who you are.
I have been collecting these bags for a minute. They're also a great investment.
Wow, sorry. You owe about $190 left?
Yeah.
All right, Hummer EV. Did you see my other Hummer video with the guy that was like $100,000 upside down?
Yeah.
Alternative investments do have a lot of attractive qualities for sophisticated investors that know how to effectively use them. Assets like commercial real estate, patents, private equity, distressed debt, commodities, and even some collectibles have been purchased by wealthy people as part of their broader investment strategy because they do actually have a few advantages. The value of these assets are often uncorrelated to the return of the stock market, which means that if you are a wealthy individual that loses their job during a market crash, you won't have to sell your investment at record low prices to stay afloat because some of your alternative investments should still be doing fine. If you just had investment in equities and lost your high-paying job in a market crash, you might be forced to sell your shares at the bottom of the market, which, as the finance bros say, is not awesome. Some alternative investments also let their investors have more control over their value. If you own a boring, old, well-diversified stock portfolio, there isn't much you can do to make the whole stock market more valuable. If you own a piece of commercial real estate or even something like artwork, you can market it, or do it up, which might help improve its sale price. Alternative investments also generally have less competitive markets. If you are trying to find an edge in the market for stocks or bonds, you are going up against teams of quantitative analysts from Jane Street and Citadel Securities who did a 4-year math program at MIT just to eke out 5 basis points of alpha. You might actually know something about a niche alternative investment that does genuinely give you an edge without it bordering on insider trading because the Securities and Exchange Commission really doesn't care about what happens in these markets. Now, if you are an industry insider, that could be a really good thing. But more likely for you, it's a really bad thing. So before you go and rethink that Masterworks investment, you should also know about the long list of drawbacks with alternative investments. They are normally highly illiquid because the market for them is niche, which means finding a competitive buyer can sometimes take years. They are also much more expensive to buy and sell. You can buy stocks on any number of commission-free brokerages, and while they do have some hidden fees, they are barely a rounding error. If you want to sell a piece of artwork, piece of jewelry, or some other collectible, you are probably going to need to go through an auction house or third-party dealer. Sotheby's, for example, is the most well-known auction house in the world, and they charge a 20% commission on any sale under $10 million, which is actually paid by the buyer. Any investment where you are automatically 20% down the moment you make your purchase is going to be risky, at best. But let's be honest, most of you watching aren't seriously considering a multi-million dollar artwork to round out your investment strategy. And if you are seriously considering a syndicated artwork investment system, then I have really failed to teach you how money works. The alternative investments that have really been generating all the attention are manufactured luxury goods that can't keep up with demand, or intentionally limit production to create a sense of exclusivity. High-end luxury watches from brands like Patek Philippe and Rolex, limited-run cars, as well as certain designer shoes and handbags all have long waitlists from authorized dealers that can stretch for years before you're even allowed to drop 5 figures on a fashion accessory. This has created a huge gray market for these items where people can wait to buy a bag or a watch from these stores and then sell them for a premium to a buyer who just wants their new toy right now. Something that you can buy one day and then instantly sell the next day for a huge premium sounds like the most risk-free investment there is, and it would be if it actually worked like that. People have seen the opportunity to make some easy money and have ran with it so hard that there are even sites that collate sales data to make trackable indexes, which, as you can see, have not been telling a good story about the actual performance of these investments. It might be unsurprising to you, but the hype around these markets is also highly correlated with the hype around other alternative investments like cryptocurrencies. And with the current massive rally in dog-themed financial instruments and other such nonsense, we gotta talk about it before anybody else does something stupid. There is, of course, another reason why people are attracted to highly speculative alternative investments, and that's simply their potential to be a lottery ticket out of poverty. A well-diversified portfolio of stocks, bonds, and real estate is an incredibly powerful tool to build wealth. But if you don't have any wealth to begin with, even Warren Buffett-level returns won't make you wealthy within your lifetime unless you can make consistent contributions towards those investments. Cryptocurrencies, meme stocks, trading cards, and even straight-up gambling is giving hope to a lot of people, even if for most of them it will only make their problems worse. But for the lucky few who did time their purchases correctly, they have turned incidental amounts of money into very substantial positions. The people that have sold out of these positions have a higher propensity to consume, especially on luxury goods to show off their new fortunes, which was in part why the aftermarket for luxury goods saw such a boom from 2020 to 2022. The trend was so strong that these items were seen as investments themselves. The brands themselves, although they would never publicly admit it, heavily played into this idea of scarcity by limiting their production of popular products and raising prices above the rate of inflation year after year to make it seem like it was a privilege to pay the price of a family SUV for a watch. At the end of the day, these are companies with a profit motive, and the only reason they would limit production is because it would increase the premium they could charge. Paying $50,000 for a watch seems stupid. But if someone that just made a fortune on a monkey JPEG is willing to buy it off you for $100,000, then it's just responsible investing. But what is particularly interesting is why this isn't happening again this time. The price of highly risky investments is up, but the price of all the junk that people normally buy when their doggy coin moons has stayed down. So, what gives? The logical answer is that sports betting and meme coin speculators have suddenly become very fiscally responsible. And instead of blowing their profits on babbling goods to show off their newfound wealth, they are prudently investing it into a structured portfolio to provide them with a stable return. Yeah, okay. So there are actually three things that have happened here. These dumb expensive trinkets that people insisted were great investments are actually an indication of a much bigger shift in the economy and habits of retail investors. The first big change is that these markets, which used to be made up of small-time, unsophisticated investors, have become just as consolidated, if not more consolidated than traditional equities markets, with the largest, wealthiest investors controlling a huge share of the total supply of things like cryptocurrencies. Bitcoin going from 20k to 90k in a year will make people a lot of money, but it's going mainly to the type of people that already had a lot of money to put into a risky investment. It's a huge return, but to someone who only had $1,000 to invest, it's not going to make them life-changing amounts of money like it would have if they invested early in the 2010s. If the Winklevoss twins make an extra $1 billion on the appreciation of Bitcoin, they are not going to wear 100,000 Patek Philippe's, which means even though the net wealth creation might be the same, the resulting propensity to consume is much lower when the rewards are going to people who could have already purchased any luxury good they ever wanted. For many of the small investors who want a chance to make life-changing amounts of money from their limited capital, the boat has already sailed on Bitcoin, which is why people keep falling for rug pull after rug pull on the promise that this time will be different, because they simply need the chance. The reason that people are making these gambles is also different. A Wall Street Journal survey of investors with low FICO scores found that their primary reason for investing was not to build wealth, but to pay off debt. Credit card debt is now approaching all-time highs, and interest rates on all kinds of borrowing is up. So even when people are lucky enough to turn a profit on these extremely risky investments, they are just going back to square one, not actually getting ahead. 4 years ago, dumb investments were turning people's stimulus checks into enough money for a down payment on a Lamborghini Urus. Today, they are lucky if it pays off their heavily underwater car loan. People are no longer being greedy. They are just being desperate. Now, you have probably experienced this cultural shift from the pandemic-era exuberance to the more cautious financial environment today, even though most macroeconomic indicators are up and to the right. But these investments are also getting hurt by a market where none of you are watching from, which hasn't even been able to make its broad economic indicators look good. China has become the largest market in the world for luxury goods because the country has produced a lot of wealthy people very quickly, and those people are eager to show off their newfound fortunes with luxury goods. Unfortunately, real estate, the primary wealth generator in China and the single largest asset market in the entire world, has been floundering since Evergrande and other major property developers started failing and flooding the market with more apartments at fire sale prices. This wealth destruction, along with a strong push by the government to crack down on extravagant displays of wealth, has meant demand for luxury goods in the country has fallen, at the same time as luxury good companies have expended to keep up with demand that has disappeared. It should go without saying, but even really smart people can do stupid things with their money if they want something to be true. A lot of people want to convince themselves that their new luxury purchase is not only a nice toy, but a prudent investment, when it simply isn't. Even if there is a premium between retail price and what it could be sold for in the gray market, you normally have to spend a lot of money at authorized dealers before you're allowed to get to the front of the waitlist. After that, the risk-adjusted returns are probably very bad, if not non-existent. If you want to invest your money, invest your money. If you want to buy something nice to treat yourself by buying something nice, treat yourself. Don't compromise and do both poorly.